Les colloques du Collège de France.
Ok, so let's start over. I have the pleasure to introduce Catherine Smetana. So she is a tenure track assistant professor in the Department of Mathematical Sciences
at Stephen Institute of Technology. And so she will speak today about a certified randomized model order reduction method with high dimensional approximation. I must say that I know Catherine from a long time. We met in when she was a postdoc with Tony Patera.
Thank you, Ivo, for the super nice introduction and for the invitation to the symposium. It's really wonderful, and congratulations again for being the chair of the Collège de France. So I want to first acknowledge funding by NSF via the following award number. And then let's begin with the motivation. So what we're interested in here is that we want to look at large scale and multi-scale problem. As you can see, for instance, for this wind turbine up here, where you see that, for instance, the blade of the wind turbine is on the meter scale, and then you see that the design is quite intricate, and if you go smaller and smaller, then you see you also have a woven material, so you see all these things interact and give you multi-scale features. Other examples are, for instance, subsurface flow. And then we can think of several things. One is that we can think of designing such wind turbines and plates, and then we have several parameters coming in, like the material and the design, of course. And then this easily gets a problem where the parameter dimension is high. Additionally, we can also think of digital twins, where we might want to put sensors and then maybe observe defects. And in this case, because we have to take into account quite a few defects, this can also contribute to being high dimensional. And just one small side note, so what you typically would like to do in this case, because you have multi-scale problems, you would try to decompose the global computational domain and then the local ansatz spaces. And then the methods that I'm going to present today can also be used to construct these local ansatz spaces in a certain manner for nonlinear problems. And again, then you have high dimensional problems, because in this case then the boundary data becomes a parameter. Another example where we can think of is seismic imaging. This is working, we're working on with seismologists, where we try to find an image about of the subsurface to help with assessing the earthquake risks in the respective area. And in this case, in seismic applications, the dimension of the high fidelity space is easily in the billions. So that means if you do inverse problems or even try to do uncertainty quantification, which is usually really hard, then you really have high dimensional space. So let me just start by writing down some notation. This is very brief. So we want to approximate our usual solution manifold M, where U solves the PDE depending on some parameter mu. P, set of admissible parameters. For simplicity, we assume that V is a Hilbert space, so the second part also works for Banach space, and make it a little bit easier in terms of notation. Then we have two situations. The first one is that P is just the usual vector, and then we look at the following probability space, but we also want to allow that our parameter space is actually infinite dimensional, and then just for formal purpose, because otherwise it's not defined, we look at this function u of y, where y is a random variable that goes from our sample space omega to an infinite dimensional space p, and then we look at this slightly different probability space. But for most of the talk, this is not really too relevant. Okay, and then we are all too familiar with the curse of dimensionality. If we want to approximate that well, if we want to put points in here and want to ensure that every point in P is as close to the training set, then we run into the curse dimensionality, because this set where we p-train, where we actually calculate the solutions, the dimension goes exponentially, the cardinality of that goes exponentially in dimension of the parameter space. So what is the idea? Just in the small box. So what we exploit is that many quantities that we're interested in think of the solution itself, actually, usually, or hours behave like sub-Gaussian random variables. And the most easiest thing that you think of, and that's actually all that we're going to use all the time, are bounded random variables. That simply means that the map from omega to the Hilbert space is bounded. That's all you need. And then the nice thing is that then we get concentration properties that remain effective in high-dimensional settings. So let's come to the first part, where we have non-asymptotic bounds for the proper orthogonal decomposition, or so principal component analysis. And this is a joint work with my students at Stevens and Tommaso, who is also here today. Okay, so just again that we're notationally all on the same side. So we seek an n-dimensional space, V, N, and V, and then we try to find an optimal space in the sense that we try to minimize the projection error in expectation. It's well known how to solve the problem. Well, we define the covariance operator, and then the eigenfunctions of this covariance operator give the optimal space, and we also have the expression for the POD error. Of course, usually this expectation cannot be calculated, so that means the usual approximation, we just do Monte Carlo. Then again, we get a space Vn hat, which is defined via the eigenfunctions of this approximate Monte Carlo estimator. And then, of course, the question is, how big is our empirical POD error? Or in other words, how many snapshots do we need to get a small error? So here's the result. Again, we just assume that the random variable is, the solution, sorry, is bounded. And then that the C1 exists, that you have that, so you can ignore that it's usually always satisfied. And then let me first go to result, and then we can quickly talk about the assumption. So what you have here on the left, you have the projection error, and then you have the usual expectation, which goes over the parameter, right? That's all new. The only difference is maybe now that you have a second expectation, which is due to the fact that you have a random space here. We also do have bounds in high probability where you then only get the typical BOD error, so expectation over the parameter, and then the expectation over the random space completely disappeared. So what is the result? So we recall that this is the optimal rate you can get for POD, and what you observe here, that if this guy here is constant, then you're basically just off by a constant of the optimal approximation. And down here you have concentration terms that usually go down exponentially in the number of samples. So just to highlight again, so we do have here, in contrast to many other results, you have a multiplication. You have a multiplication with the optimal POD error with 1 over the samples, right? So it's not a plus or something like that, where the number of samples has to go like 1 over the error squared. So that means we can really benefit from a rapid eigenvalue decay. And also very important, so there is no dependence on the dimension of the parameter space in there anywhere. The parameter space can be infinite dimensional. It does not have any effect at all on the result. So coming to this term here, so if you compare the second term that you have up there, and this guy down here, they're basically the same except for the 4 and the 16. And then we have a similar assumption up there, so that we need these two terms to be constant. So what does it mean in actual practice? Well, if we look at some examples, first let's look at a fixed spectral gap. Then the bound, including the concentration term, that's the second part back here, goes approximately like follows. So I have again the optimal POD error. In front you have a term that goes like 1 over the samples. and you have a term that goes exponentially down the number of samples, and you have this term here up front, which usually is not too bad. If you have polynomial decay, then, well, you have to make sure that the number of samples resolves the spectral gap. Otherwise, this term that we have here up front will grow, which is, of course, undesired. If you do that, which is usually, I still believe, not too bad, I mean, if you have, like, alpha being a 2 rate, it goes up like n squared, and n, again, is the dimension of the reduced space and not, of course, the high fidelity space, which would be completely prohibitive. Usually that is still something that can often be done. And then we get really similar result as above. This term changes a little bit, and I think this is really pessimistic, so I put it into MATLAB, and there you got like n times log n squared. So we need to improve that estimate a little bit to get these terms here smaller. Okay, so let me come back 1 second. Let me just say one more sentence on this assumption. So heuristically, when this assumption does, it ensures that the empirical eigenvalues do not cross. So that's a typical assumption that you do for POD if you do this perturbation bounds. You would, in theory, you should not need it here because you analyze the error and not the difference and how well you approximate the space. This is due to how the proof is going. But okay, so in the moment we do have that assumption, and usually it's not too bad. Okay. So how do the results advance the state of the art? So if we compare, which one of the closest probably, non-asymptotic results for bounded random variables, so there what you have here, that's this work by Ibsen and co-workers, where they analyze that in the context of active subspaces. In this case, the number of sample needs to go like 1 over epsilon squared. And here, epsilon is the target relative error in the approximation of the covariance metrics. So you see that it's way worse than in our case, where if you have a fixed spectral gap, m does not at all need to be related with the error. And in this case, it's also about matrices, and they don't consider the infinite dimensional space. So let me also discuss the relation with this result here, which is usually considered, to the best of my knowledge, like a state of the art for PCA at the moment. So here, they have really nice results. So what they show, for instance, is that if you have an exponential decay of the eigenvalues, then you need like number of dimension of the reduced space, many samples only, to get the same convergence rate as the POD, like the same exponential convergence rate, which is really nice. However, this paper requires a rather strict assumption. So it looks at this bounded variable. You should take your solution snapshots in the inner product with all functions of your Hilbert space, and then it requires that the sub-Gaussian norm is bounded by constant times the variance. And that assumption is actually often difficult to verify and also doesn't necessarily hold for bounded and random variables. So we do have a counterexample where we clearly show you cannot find a C1 that is bounded if you look if you choose a certain bounded random variables. What I now want to show next afterwards is actually it's also in generally a little tricky. So what we want to do now, next in the numerical experiment, so we want to look at the POD eigenmodes. Why? Because for the POD eigenmodes, we know that the variance just equals the eigenvalues, right? So that means we know from the eigenvalues they should go to zero, because we want to have reduction. So that means automatically, as I said, this has to hold for all functions, so we just need to find a few where it's problematic, or one even. And for the POD, we know the POD modes, the rest part, if you replace V by the POD modes, this guy will be zero. So then the question is, do you find functions where the left part is not zero? And in this case, we can think of scenarios which are actually very common, that you just have some things happening in areas of the parameter space of relatively small measure, which can still be relevant, of course, for the approximation over the overall features that are happening in the problem. And what we have here is the following example. So we have a nonlinear diffusion. This the nonlinear diffusion term is modeled by a model that comes from two-phase flow. And then we have here that addition, which rarely activates, you can see them up here and up here, down here, some high conductivity channels. So you have channels where you have a very, very high diffusion, which is 10 to the 5, but it only gets activated really, rarely. So mu1 is like uniformly distributed on 0,1, and we only activate it about 10% of the time. So why is that at least a semi-realistic example? Well, I think now we have a heat wave, and then very likely at some point there will be a thunderstorm. So then you have intense rainfall goes down, and then you have exactly the situation in subsurface flow. You have rain, and then you get these high conductivity channels, which work like highways for your water and really transport things very quickly. And now what we see, so we plot here what we had on the previous slide. We plot like the discrete L infinity norm and the discrete average, and you really see that if you increase the number of POD modes, it goes up. It goes up. Even if it's not really going to infinity, obviously that can't be because here we look everything at finite dimension, the C1 constant really goes really heavily in their result. It's to the power of force or something like that. So that really is a problem at some point. Okay, and for this case, we really see nicely, as we would hope, that the projection error is not affected too much if we change the number of samples. We start at 10,000 and then we reduce. Why we choose such a hard and large number? Because here we shut on these high conductivity channels so rarely, so we want to make sure that we shut them on at all. In usual practice, you would need much less samples. And similarly, the eigenvalues are not affected. Okay, so where are we? So we saw that for many problems, actually, a modest number of samples is sufficient to get an accurate approximation independently of the dimension of the parameter space. And then, hopefully, I was able to convince you that with the numerical experiments, they really suggest that the current state of the art results for PCA, they're really restrictive for parametric PDEs. So if you have low energy modes that correspond to solution features that appear only rarely in parameter space, then you're in trouble, which really highlights the relevance of our results. So one other experiment we're thinking of, we're discussing with Tommaso, is to think, for instance, of Navier-Stokes, where you have like rare vortex jetting or something like that. It's not clear whether things have to be that rare at all in order to cause any problems. Okay, so this is the baseline so far. And what we did not do is, so we only assumed basically boundedness. So we did not assume anything on the distribution. So how did we sample or something like that? Principally just uniform and you still get that result. Now, how can you improve? First, of course, the usual approach is also to exploit the structure of the problem. But what I want to talk about here is the sampling strategy. Okay. So let's make things a little bit easier to discuss. So let's move, for the sake of this part, from our solution fold to a matrix. So we simply stack solutions evaluated on certain samples in the matrix here. And then what is our goal? The equivalent goal is then, well, we want to find a subset of columns. So we find good, for instance, this guy here, this orange and this pink guy, such that the projection error is small with high probability. And then what are good strategies for column subset selection? Again, this is then the equivalent question that we just tried to answer earlier for the POD. And this is a really well established problem in linear algebra. So let's start.
When you say the high probability, it's because you assume that you have a probability on the parameter.
Precisely. Yes, sorry, I should have specified, yes. What we're going to do is we're going to put a probability distribution on the columns. Yes. So let's start off what is typically not a great idea, and that's uniform sampling. To see, well, let's just look at the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is all information is concentrated in one single column. Every other column is zero. You will easily see this is terrible in order to find the information that you're looking for. So how can we identify the informative regions of the parameter space? The first thing that curbs the problem that we just had is we do squared norm sampling. So that means we put the probability distribution like this, and then this means we take the two norm of the i's column, and then we divide it by the sum over all norms. Naturally, if this norm is zero, as we had on the previous slide, this will sample with probability zero from the respective column. And as you see here, indeed, then for areas where your matrix is completely zero, you have a probability zero. So that's good. Let's look at these examples down here. So the white parts, the matrix is zero, and the blue parts here, you have the same value. Then you have it here, just moved up, and the same on this side. However, these examples also show that also squared norm sampling has its disadvantages. If we look here on the left side, basically we only need to sample one single time here, right? But we desperately should also sample here in order to get this small scale feature. But we see, well, it puts a lot of probability here, so we'll likely go a lot on here and maybe not hit that guy. Similarly here, where it just looks at the norm, if you have a feature which is a very high norm and something which has a much smaller norm, it will not sample too much from here, even though it's equally important. So that means, well, we still have issues, especially with problems that have different scales. So how can we do better? So how can we find areas that are really important for approximation? And the approach that's usually used here is a so-called leverage score sampling. So you build a probability distribution from the right, from the leading and right singular vectors of your matrix M. And then this solves our problem very nicely, because you see them now red dotted. So here on the left, it put a little, but not too much probability on this huge block and a lot on this tiny plot here. So it really equally distributes it between the two parts to make sure we sample from these guys too. And equally here, it ignores the scale as it should, but it only looks at how important the respective regions are for approximation. And then one can even get theoretical results. So one can show, that was done in 2018, for instance, in this paper, that you're then off by a constant factor of the optimal approximation. Again, of course, in high probability, but the scaling here is not so great, but there are newer results like adaptive leverage score sampling that I'm not talking about today, which can significantly improve that. Okay, so summary so far, we see leverage score sampling seems to do a really good job in terms of sampling. So now let's try to go back to our infinite dimensional setting. Okay. So we leave the discrete setting again, where we put everything in a matrix and go back to the manifold. We keep that in both cases. We assume that we have some space un with some phi phi n, which are orthogonal. We just used the leverage scores, which were built on the previous slide from the right singular vectors. But here we just assume that we have some subspace that gives a relatively good approximation. Right singular vectors are already also normalized. Here we didn't assume that, so that's why we have to normalize here. And then the leverage scores give you directly the probability distribution to describe. In the infinite dimensional setting, one analog is the Christoffel function. So we sum over our our basis functions, and here we normalize this time with an integral because we're now in the continuous version again. And then we can define the Christoffel measure just like this. So that tells us that Christoffel sampling is really one natural analog of the leverage score sampling in the continuous setting. and it quantifies approximation relevance. In addition, there have been results by Quen, Dolbo, Miklorati, Akinarian, and Xu that show that Christoffel sampling also performs well in detecting large values, which means that it's also good in terms of certification, which brings us back to the original goal of this talk. And also to the next section, which is about the randomized greedy algorithm, which is work together with my student Charlie at Stevens. Okay, so what do we do? So we input some finite probability measure rho and some error tolerance, and then in each iteration, we draw mn independent samples from our Christoffel measure. And then we enrich the solution Uy star, where, well, we take the usual argmax here. And then we terminate if we're below the tolerance. So both for theoretical and algorithmic viewpoints, it's better to keep a little bit of uniform sampling here, so not only use the Christoffel function, but some additional constant and weighted too. And also note that in this case, we basically do, for the people who are familiar with Christoffel sampling, we basically do Christoffel sampling, but with one single basis function, which is the error, right? We only evaluate the error. And for theoretical purposes, we assume that the PDE is stable for rho almost every parameter. But that's it. That's all we need. Okay. So, challenges. If we look back, we still have this L2 norm down here, which is, of course, prohibitive. However, that can easily be cured. So if you replace the L2 norm by an estimator, then you get a practical algorithm, which you can run. And then by Höfting's inequality, that practical algorithm basically has the same theoretical results than the ideal one that you see here. In terms of sampling from the distribution, so far we used slice sampling and that worked well, but of course that is somehow problem dependent. But I don't want to talk about that so far, but so far, as I said, we use slice sampling, which scales linearly in the parameter dimension. Okay, needless to say, but I wanted to remark it anyhow, we can replace the error by an a posteriori estimator, and then the number, the computational costs is, of course, less. You don't have to, though. So then here's the result. So again, we have our probability space from the beginning. Here we assume that the P is an RP. We assume that rho and the Lebesgue measure are equivalent. That means that every set of positive rho measure also has positive Lebesgue measure. And then we draw MN IID samples from the Christoffel measure, and MN here is our sampling budget. And what you see is it's actually really small. So alpha N, you can choose, for instance, 1/2 or something like that. It only merely minorly affects this constant down here. So no need that to choose small at all. And then you have that the failure probability delta N, which you can choose, enters logarithmically. That means if you choose, like, I don't know, 10 to the power of minus 12, well, you get like a 12. So this whole thing is order of 10 in each iteration. And then what we get, well, with probability at least 1 minus delta n, we can bound really the L infinity norm of the error, but on the whole parameter set, right? Not on the training set only, but this gives you certification on the whole parameter set. That means there is no need to any assessment of the accuracy of your reduced model. No a posteriori estimator, it's done. So you can pass on the reduced model, online stage, no assessment of accuracy necessary anymore. And this can be bounded by this constant time the max over the error of the samples. And I'm come to speak about that constant guy in a moment, because you can argue, okay, Cn has been defined as the Christoffel function, so the error here is involved, so you need to find the L infinity norm of that. Why is that actually not bad? It's not bad. I'll address it in a moment, though. Okay, so again, per iteration, we can bound the error over the whole parameter set by the max over few samples. Few means order of 10. And by union bound argument, you can also certify the whole algorithm. Okay, estimating this constant. So the first thing what we observe in our numerical experiments is that this constant does not contribute to the convergence rate. And it appears in the square root, so that means basically you can be somewhat conservative there. So you just use sort of a little bit of a crude upper estimate and then you're usually good. Understandably, if you're not happy with that, then one can do more. And the key point here is that Cn is a density function. So that means that gives us a lot of additional information we can work on to get theoretical results. The first, most simplest one that I didn't put even on the slide is, well, for a density function, you automatically get that the measure of sets where the density function exceeds C is 1 over C. So you automatically see it can only have very large values on sets of small measure, just because it's a density. And we can do better as follows. So let's consider the good set here. That's why it's called GGN. So what do we do on GN? So we want to build an estimator by just doing a few samples to estimate Cn. And then we want to see whether this few samples gives us an upper bound on this L-infinity norm. So again, Cn will be our estimator, and then we subtract the mean, and we multiply it with some safety factor, which you can choose. It, because Cn is a density, we know the expectation is 1, so there's nothing to estimate there. And then what we get is, for the Christoffel measure, so we can then bound the measure of the set, where we have that no draw belongs to Gn. That means we draw m estimate times, and every time we miss the good set. So that means really our upper bound is not an upper bound, it's actually smaller. But the measure of that set where we are not an upper bound is actually small. In particular, you have this mest up here, so it decays again exponentially in the number of samples. So basically, with a few samples, you usually should be good and really can ensure that the measure of the set where you're not exceeding your L-infinity norm is not too big. And you can help your significantly, of course, by choosing a large safety factor here, which again is not too problematic because that enters only as a square root and from our numerical experiments does not affect the convergence order. Okay, and again to highlight, so basically very high values really usually only appear on sets of small measure. Okay, more. So we can also show that the randomized greedy yields a quasi-optimally converging approximation. So in each iteration, the randomized greedy selects a near maximizing parameter with high probability. This is just the result that I presented earlier, the pair iteration result. Just copy and paste it again for ease. For the deterministic greedy, which was introduced 2003 by Verreuil, Prudhomme, Robas, and Pata, we know that it selects the global maximizer in each iteration. And because the randomized greedy selects a near maximizing parameter, we can relate the two, and then we can benefit from results on the deterministic greedy to conclude that also the randomized greedy converges at a quasi-optimal rate, so the same rate actually, which is slightly worse than the Kolmogorov-Ahn width. Just a slight remark, so what we're doing at the moment is, so we're slightly adapting the result in there, because in their case they had like the constant of the weak greedy was like constant through all the iterations. We adapted it slightly now that the constant can change in the iterations. So then that allows us to get different constants throughout the iteration and slightly improves this result. Okay, of course, we are by very far we're not the first people who try to address these issues, like the two that I mentioned first, high dimensionality, and the second one that we do not have a certification from the deterministic greedy over the whole set, but only on the training set. I want to particularly highlight this paper by Cohen and co-workers from 2020, And the idea here is very similar. The main differences are two. So what they assume basically is they assume in their paper that the error can be well approximated by polynomials. And that, as a consequence, then reduces the applicability of the result to problems where this is really not the case. And the second difference is then the results they use are similar to techniques, but they then use the results on the space of polynomials where the things are a bit easier to calculate. But nevertheless, so we borrowed some of our ideas from their paper. Then there's a lot of works on adaptive updates or partitioning of the training set. We saw one talk on that yesterday. And then also work on nonlinear optimization and also, of course, tensor approaches. Okay, so let's look at a problem. So, small disclaimer, so this example actually does not strictly satisfy the assumption in our problem, but we chose this because we wanted to see how it the algorithm performs if you try to test it on a problem that is hard for the randomized greedy. So why is it hard? Because you have Helmholtz problem, you have two parameters, here and here, and then you get this resonance surfaces, and then, of course, every time you add a resonance, the value of the solution grows. And that immediately means what you observe, that the randomized greedy, you get like really high peaks of this Christoffel function. So then the sampling becomes more challenging and the estimates get challenging. So we wanted to see whether it's still able to deal with such a problem. And it is. So you see here in black the deterministic greedy, and then you see several realizations for the randomized greedy, and here we take only 40 samples per iteration, and you see, well, it performs nearly the same. Why do you have that flat region at the beginning? So basically at the beginning, both the deterministic and the randomized greedy, they pick up the resonance surfaces, which they need to represent, and then you get the decay. And also important here on the right, so here we estimated the maximum, the L infinity of the error on a very dense grid, and compared it with our sample maximum, again, for 40 samples per iteration. And you see what I said earlier. So basically, they converge nearly the same, which really underlines the statement that I had earlier, that we do not need to get the precise estimates of this L infinity norm for Cn. So we can be grouped there, and we still get a nice convergence result. Okay, and with that, I would like to thank for your attention and just summarize quickly. So again, the goal was to approximate the solution manifold, and the key idea is that under mild conditions, many quantities we're interested in behave like subgaussians. So for the POD, we get that for many problems, a modest number of samples is sufficient to get an accurate approximation independently of the dimension of the parameter space. And then if you use data-dependent sampling strategies, you can really, which also was alluded to by Antoni this morning, you can really make sure that you sample in a very efficient way to get the information you need. And based on that, we developed the randomized greedy, which really provides certification over the whole parameter set by relying on this measure that really ensures sampling from areas with high approximation error. Thanks.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.